Hey listeners, welcome to Trust in Tech, where we have conversations with folks helping the internet and society thrive. Today, we have a conversation with Caroline Sinders. Caroline is a machine learning design researcher, online harassment expert, and artist. Previously, she has worked with Facebook, Amnesty International, Intel, IBM Watson, and the Wikimedia Foundation. She is currently founder of Convocation Design, an agency that focuses on the intersection of machine learning, user research, designing for the public good, and solving difficult communication problems. We answer following questions on today's show. What are dark tech patterns and how do we prevent them? How to navigate multi-stakeholder groups to prevent baking in dark patterns? What is a public person? What is a framework to approach data visualization? And finally, how is photography an analog to generative AI? This episode goes in lots of directions to cover Caroline's varied interests, and let me know if you enjoy it. On to the show. Hey, Caroline, welcome to the show.
Hi, yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Let's start off with the recent event you had through the Integrity Institute about dark tech patterns. Can you explain what they are and maybe a little bit more about them?
Yeah, so dark patterns, often referred to as deceptive design patterns, or as I refer to them, harmful design patterns, are design patterns that unintentionally or intentionally manipulate, confuse, or exploit users into making decisions they normally wouldn't make. And they're actually pretty prolific in the sense that they really are all around the web. Like anyone listening to this, you've probably encountered multiple harmful design patterns even today without realizing it. If you've ever tried to subscribe and then unsubscribe from a service and found it was really difficult or really confusing, and then a week later you were still subscribed, you probably encountered a harmful design pattern. If you've ever tried to book like a plane ticket on like a budget airline, like a Ryanair, you've encountered harmful design patterns. And so they really are kind of everywhere. And in the UK and the EU, where I've been living in both places for the past few years, there has been this push towards regulation and investigation of harmful design patterns, but also in the US as well. So the FTC has been, you know, really kind of leading the way in investigating and creating fines related to harmful design patterns. The California privacy law, I think, also explicitly mentions harmful design patterns, or there's like another law in California that is calling out harmful design patterns to try to curb their influence and how prolific they are.
Yeah, so I guess they don't appear in a vacuum, right? So is it the case that, I mean, someone has an incentive to make these design patterns, right? And I feel like it just ends up being, oh, if you subscribe and unsubscribing is harder, is just a easy way to get revenue. I would consider green text for Android also a dark pattern or harmful design pattern. Is regulation the only way to prevent these harmful design patterns, or is it something with the incentive structure in of itself?
I think it's a mixture of things. I will say that, like, I think oftentimes a lot of really well-meaning designers end up inadvertently creating dark patterns. Like, I think some are done on purpose and I think some are not. To sort of step back out of that for a second, I don't think it's useful to look at intentionality in terms of harmful design patterns. And the reason for that is intentionality is really difficult to prove. So if we kind of enter a landscape in which determining harmful design patterns means we have to think about if they're really intentional, it means that there's a lot of harm that we can't call out. It also makes it incredibly difficult for regulators and investigators to determine harm, right? Or like decide like intention, right? And that can be incredibly difficult to prove because you kind of need like a smoking gun of an email of someone being like, this is confusing, but let's use it anyway. And those kinds of emails don't really exist very often. But one thing I will say is, you know, when I reflect on my time in industry, because I used to work in advertising and then I made the jump to working at IBM, I worked with Facebook and Google in the past as well. You know, like when I reflect on a lot of my time, especially in advertising, like there are a lot of things that we considered either best practices or things that were, you know, very paternalistic views of design, like things we thought were good for the consumer, like targeted ads, like being able to show people relevant ads. You know, some people consider those harmful design patterns because the user doesn't actually have enough agency or making a lot of assumptions on behalf of the user. So when you look at then harmful design patterns related to cookies, like cookie banners and cookie tracking, it's actually really difficult to opt out completely of cookies in a lot of circumstances. And those are harmful design patterns, but you can understand or walk through a process in which you could see how a designer was sitting there saying, you know, relevant cookies to the consumer is important because it gives them products they're interested in. So this is where I don't necessarily think it's intentional, but we have to kind of shift our mindsets as designers around what is good in heavy quotes for the user. And how did we come up with that? Like, what assumptions or decisions are we making on behalf of the user that really actually more benefit our bottom line than it does the user's bottom line? And by our bottom line, I mean like our company's bottom line, for example. And so I think that's a part of this. I don't think there's an easy answer for why harmful design patterns happen, because I think it's many layers of many different things. One thing I hold a lot of empathy for, because I'm a former UX designer and design researcher. I still do design research, but I work mainly in human rights. But I hold a lot of empathy for how difficult it is to design products, because designing products is one of the hardest things I think you can do, because you're designing something that has to fit like one of the most plural contexts, a global context, because you're never really, really designing something just for one group or for one area. Because even a city or a neighborhood will have, right, many different kinds of people with many different kinds of needs. We're never just designing something for like one discrete user group, right? Because there's always nuances in that user group. So being a UX designer, I think, is an incredibly challenging and complex job. It's what I really liked about UX design. But I think like this is part of what makes harmful design patterns an interesting phenomenon, but also a hard one, is that just the aspect of making product design for many different people with many different needs is already really challenging. This is why I think it's important to also have some empathy, or rather some extension of understanding, that design is a hard job and that sometimes these things happen unintentionally. But there are spaces and times where things happen intentionally. It's hard to prove, but I've definitely seen design out there where I think like, oh yeah, this is the product and the company being really tricky. They know exactly what they're doing. These buttons have been switched. The language is so confusing. Like, this is like almost like a trap that you have to be very clear of how to get out of, right? And those things definitely exist out there. They're online. There's like really good documentation. Harry Bringle's Twitter account, Deceptive Design Patterns, documents some of these. He documents a lot of harmful design patterns, but he also documents some of these like really egregious ones. The ones where you look at and you're like, this feels like very planned. It feels very intentional. So to go back to your question, I think there's many different things that need to happen. I do think some of this is education for designers, but I don't think that's the only thing. I think a lot of this needs to be regulation. I think a lot of this needs to be different ways that you can impact the executive level of companies. So like different people really up at the top, they're holding powerful decisions that have kind of final say in what things look like and how things are shipped. I think a lot of this is also providing spaces for policy and legal teams to interact more with design teams, to be able to really look at something and ask, like, is this compliant? Which is not something that necessarily happens all the time. Like, that kind of collaboration on the product level of being able to bring legal in to like impact design, like that doesn't necessarily happen. That maybe happens at the end sometimes, right? Really far removed from like the design team. So I think those are just like a few things and a few ways, again, including regulation, that we can help sort of try to combat or mitigate harmful design patterns.
There's a few threads that you touched on. One was the mindset shift for designers. And I think that kind of ties into the partial solution of education for designers. What are the mindset shifts here? Having some empathy for designers. Then another thing you said was different ways to impact the top of the company or leadership in a company. And then also providing spaces for policy and legal. Before we go down these threads, though, I think it'd be very helpful for both listeners and myself to have a bit of an understanding of what your career has been so far and what's your unique angle on all these items.
Yeah. So, I mean, my career has definitely been like a bit all over the place. I started off as a photographer and photojournalist, and then I got my master's at the Interactive Telecommunications Program at NYU. which is a really fantastic interdisciplinary program. It often gets compared to like the MIT Media Lab. I think of it as like the Montessori school version of the Media Lab. It's definitely a choose your own adventure that has like suited me like really, really well. One, be able to sort of like switch expertise, being able to sort of go into a school that like really prided all different kinds of backgrounds. So that's like a big thing about ITP. So then from there, I was always interested in technology as a photographer. I was really interested in how the internet was impacting photography. So I did my undergrad degree from 2006 to 2010, and I got my master's from 2012 to 2014. So I was like finishing my undergrad degree like as Instagram was launching. But I was like sort of really in undergrad at a time where blogging was really big. Like the self-style blogger and the personal photographer blogger was like a really, really big thing. Like street style photographies, like the Sartorialist and things like that. And so actually like the structure of blogging, even though that seems so long ago, had this really deep impact on me as a photographer. Because one of the things I was interested in was, well, what does it mean to kind of create for a medium that's just the internet? And so what does it mean when like photographs are never being printed and things are being sort of made solely online to really sort of only fit a computer screen or like a cell phone screen, right? And this is even before people were like, again, really using things on their phone. Like this was the era of smartphones, but this was like at a time where major magazines weren't really investing in digital. Like they weren't really creating digital content the way they're creating now. So as a photographer, I was really interested in this. Like I was interested in how do you make products for photographers and for people that love photography online? And then what does it mean to be a person that wants to create images, a photographer, and also sort of engage with technology? So like when I was graduating undergrad, for me, an ideal job, even though I didn't have like the words at the time, would have been doing either like stuff related to creative communities and photography, so like making content and like facilitating communities, or helping sort of conceptualize products and build products for photographers and communities. I just didn't know what those words were because I hadn't gone to like a tech or design school. But I knew that that's what I wanted to do around the time I was graduating. So I worked as like a photographer's assistant and a nanny and like a product photographer. I got to assist on a bunch of really interesting shoots, like for the New York Times, which was really interesting, with this amazing photographer, Nicholas Calcutt. He's still one of my favorite photographers. He was like one of the best bosses I had. And then I got my master's at NYU, and I went there really again to focus on how do you make stuff for communities? And like, what does it mean to like make images or creative content online for communities and with communities? And then that kind of spiraled into me actually getting really interested in video games because I was interested in the future of photography. And so I thought like, how do you move beyond like a slideshow? And so I started getting really interested in hypertext and like experimental web art and video games while still studying social media. And so I was really lucky. My academic advisor was Clay Shirky. He wrote Here Comes Everybody, just sort of looking at the internet as like as a third space, as like a communal gathering ground. And I took his political use as a social media class, which was really influential to me. I was also learning UX design. And so I ended up looking at how feminist communities were utilizing the web for protest. And what that sort of led me to look at is a lot of folks were using, you know, things like Facebook, Facebook events, sort of nascently Twitter, to sort of organize online to get people to do stuff offline in response to gender-based violence, which wasn't really a term people were using, but it was around like physical harm. And so because I was looking at feminist uses of social media, gender-based violence, and video games, and I was in the video games community, and I'm sure for a lot of you probably know where this is heading, I was sort of perfectly primed to start studying Gamergate when that launched or happened, you know, starting around 2014. And that was around the time I was graduating. So I got a job in advertising, spent my 9 to 5, as I called it, as an interaction designer, and my 6 to 11, as I called my second job, doing a lot of user research and sort of embedded ethnography and like different forms of digital anthropology of like embedding and observing Gamergate. And I was interviewing different victims of Gamergate, you know, folks that had like 400,000 followers to folks that had like 200 followers, but all who were being targeted by Gamergate. And I really started thinking about at the time, how does like UX design impact safety? Because it does. And so I like gave a talk at Theorizing the Web, which is an academic conference. And at the time in academia, no one was really talking about the role that UX design or product design had on user safety. And so I was like one of the few people that was starting to sort of openly talk about that and study that and sort of think about how does tools impact safety. And around that time, I had switched jobs and I was working at IBM Watson as a design researcher on natural language processing APIs. And so I've always been interested in how complex technology sort of impacts communities, how it impacts conversations. And so that was my interest sort of at IBM, was really thinking about what role does artificial intelligence and machine learning play on language and play on conversations. I ended up getting a fellowship after that at BuzzFeed as a creative technologist, where I was able to look a lot more at machine learning and commenting sections and also online harassment and the far right. And that was a really, you know, sort of integral fellowship for me. And then I joined the Wikimedia anti-harassment team and was working sort of solely on trust and safety at that point. Again, in my 6 to 11, still doing public research and artwork sort of about internet harm. And then in 2018, I had gotten like enough side opportunities that it kind of made sense for me to start my own individual practice. And that's when I sort of left, I guess, the more corporate regular job world and started my human rights lab and my official art studio, because I was able to finally sort of devote sort of my full-time energy to that. One thing I will highlight is this is actually like a very normal journey for folks at ITP. A big thing about my master's program is that they often say they're preparing you for your last job and not your first job. And it's often like a job you end up kind of creating on your own. And I feel like that's definitely this sort of really interesting, weird world that I have now created also like for myself. So I feel really blessed about that, to be totally honest.
There's a couple of things that you said that were pretty interesting. One was they prepare you for your last job, not your first.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool. But I also think there's this thread that most people in trust and safety or integrity kind of like sideways apply to the job. Like it's normally like, oh, I just happen to be here because A, I got lucky, or B, my weird combination of experiences led me to work at this type of job. So I think like it's a master's program that kind of reinforces that instead of the traditional, oh, go work at a 9 to 5 corporate place after. It's nice to hear.
Totally. I will say, I think one of the things that's really different about my trust and safety career is I was very intentional about it. I knew that I was interested in trust and safety. I knew that I had a deep background in online harassment. I was recruited to the Wikimedia online harassment team because of my research in studying online harassment and my experience in effectively working with harassment victims. One of the things I do feel strongly about, though I always try to be really careful about this, is I do wish that companies and nonprofits that are hiring for trust and safety would also think about trust and safety expertise as like a core requirement, or at least some kind of background in that. I do think you can train folks into it, but I do think it takes a while. And I definitely experienced that in having to sort of inadvertently train my teammates who had a background in understanding Wikimedia, but like didn't have a background in trust and safety. So I feel very lucky in a way that I was able to be hired to do that job. But I also like very intentionally sought it out. So like for me, if I were to go back to big tech, which I am open to, I would only go back to like a trust and safety team or like a security team, for example, because those are the skills that I have, but those are the only interests I'm interested in still pursuing. So I think what sort of sets my work apart in a way is like I approach it maybe in a way that seems more similar to an academic, where it's like, these are my expert areas. And like, this is like the research I've decided to dedicate my expertise to. One of the things I do love about this background I've had at ITP is that it really gives you a background of being able to more quickly become a temporary expert in a way. So understanding like when you're approaching a new topic, how to do that and what is like an equitable way to do that. And also what's an interesting way to do that. So what are new ways of solving problems? What are new ways to see a problem? And I think that's an incredible skill. And I think that that's a skill that we don't really get to stretch in jobs, of being able to say, you know, what's actually like a new method here, right? Like what's a new method of analyzing this problem? What's like a new way of seeing the problem? I think a lot of times when we work in any job, be it a for-profit or a nonprofit, there is like a certain way to work. And sometimes those certain ways of working, in heavy quotes, aren't maybe the only way we should be working. Maybe that's not the only way we should be looking at a problem. And so one of the things I really liked about ITP is that it also really kind of forces you as an individual to say, okay, well, like, what's another way I can solve this problem with like only the set of materials I have available to me?
Can we get an example of when you've done that before, when you have concretely become a new expert on something, or how you went about that?
I remember when I was working on this Knight Foundation prototype grant, it was like looking at memes and like the provenance of memes and like meme tracking. And it was something where like we made a prototype. The prototype didn't work amazingly, but we generated these case studies. But one of the things I was really inspired by when I was sort of talking about what, if this were to turn into an app, what the app could be, was I got really inspired by shark tracking apps and looking at like viral apps, like medical apps. And the reason I got interested in those kinds of dashboards was you were looking at something sort of being tracked over time. So what ITP kind of taught me to do was look at something and say, okay, what's the action that's happening here versus like, what is the domain? And I think a lot of this comes from the fact that like I ended up taking a lot of data courses, like a lot of data art courses, and a lot of data visualization courses. Like I ended up taking a class with Jer Thorpe, who's an amazing data visualizer and data artist. And so like when you illustrate data, right, when you're thinking about creating a data visualization, the subject matter really matters, but also so does the nature of the data and what it's doing, right? So how is it gathered? What are the sort of constraints of the data? What are like the different data points? In some cases, what also matters is how the data is changing over time. So something like a meme that can sort of spread and evolve, right? It may start off as one thing, and so like Pepe is a great example of this. It may start off as one thing, like a funny stoner Californian comic, right? That was not very well known when it first launched, except to like a core group of fans. And then somehow was kind of overtaken by the alt-right and the far right, and then became really, really well known, and then spawned different sub-memes like Groiper, which is like a fat Pepe, you know, all different kinds of stuff. What does that seem like? Something sort of transmuting and transforming over time and spreading. Well, that can be similar to a journey maybe of an animal or like a pack of animals or a virus, right? So then how would you illustrate that over time? How would you look at that? An inspiration could be looking at how things related to maybe a pandemic, right? How was that illustrated over time? How would you sort of show that? Or, you know, looking at, again, packs of animals that travel together or not together over time, how would you illustrate those patterns to show those connections? Or how would you even like look at, let's say, weather catastrophes, like big weather patterns? And so ITP kind of really taught me to sort of look at something and then ask, what is relevant information that doesn't almost feel relevant at this? Like, how do I look at this problem and tell it in a new way? So for me, like saying, like, how do you best visualize the evolution of Pepe over time? It meant that if I wanted to tell this story as beautifully and accurately as possible through a dashboard, which is data visualization, it meant that I needed to look at things that were going through similar transformations that might not at all be in the same domain. And while this wasn't an ITP project, like ITP gave me those skills to be able to look at this problem in that way. It gave me a way of being able to solve problems that I don't think I had before.
A domain agnostic set of tools.
Yeah. One of the big things about ITP is that they put you into different groups and all different classes. And all the people in your groups have like radically different backgrounds. Like you'll be placed with like an architect and like a former school teacher and like a hardware expert, right? And you all have to work together. And so like one person can't do the project. So what that means is you're actually like working with a group of people that all have incredibly different backgrounds and incredibly different ways of problem solving and seeing a problem. And so thus, by working with them, you're kind of forced to sort of learn this interdisciplinary way of thinking and approaching, right? Almost by osmosis, just like over time, because you're sort of doing these very interdisciplinary collaborations again and again and again. And the way I think that this translates to like business skills is it means that like I'm very comfortable. This is like, I think was a big asset when I worked at IBM. I was really comfortable in moving between really different teams and learning, knowing how to translate like my knowledge into language that made sense to those different teams. So like, I'm not a research scientist, but I worked really well with the research scientists because I spent a lot of time listening to how computer scientists talked and learning how to use their language to explain like what I was working on. And then vice versa, when I had to translate that for like a business team, like a business development team, I knew how to translate what we had done into information that made sense to that team, because I had this skill set of being able to sort of intake interdisciplinary knowledge and like disseminate it and make it really actionable to these different groups. And that was like one of the big things I learned at ITP.
I see. Yeah, to kind of tie it back to what we were chatting about earlier about dark patterns, one was to provide a concrete recommendation that you had was provide spaces for policy and legal to talk to design teams. And I keep noticing this thread where a lot of the solutions that you're providing or a lot of this common or a lot of your interests kind of are at the crux of an interdisciplinary community. And I guess that's something that you picked up from ITP or your diverse career. I guess like my question is why would providing the space for policy and legal to talk to design teams be helpful in stopping dark patterns, especially if the dark patterns are not violating any regulations? And then kind of to finish the loop, you said there are different ways to impact the top, the company leadership. What are those concrete specific ways that if you're an integrity worker, how can you go up to the top of the company and speak their language?
So those are really great questions. One thing I will say is that because there is now a precedent of harmful design patterns impacting data protection regulation. So I'm a fellow right now at a regulator that works on data protection. So a lot of what I've been helping them understand is how harmful design patterns impact regulation. Privacy regulation. And we wrote this really large report that just came out. I'll also say for those listening, like I do not represent right now the regulator that I collaborate for. I just am a fellow there. I'm not providing any regulatory information or, you know, don't take this as regulatory advice. I just need to be very clear about that right now. But anyway, going back. So the thing is that there is a precedent now from European and UK regulators across data protection and competition law of harmful design patterns impacting data protection regulation and competition law. Like the CNIL has sort of ruled on different GDPR impacts. We have the Norwegian Consumer Council putting out really groundbreaking reports on big tech. You know, the Italian privacy regulator has already been fining many big tech companies related to GDPR violations. Germany has as well. So the thing about it is, if you work on a product, it's probably being used in the EU. Like, let's just be really straight up about that. Almost every product can be utilized or used there. So your harmful design patterns are violating regulation. Like, that just is what it is. But also, like, again, the FTC is going after harmful design patterns. So, like, if you work in the US, like, you can face regulation. Like, that is a real thing. We may not have strong regulation here in the US compared to Europe, but we have regulation. So the thing I always like to say is like, you actually might most likely could be violating regulation and you just don't know it because you aren't working with a legal team, right? So that's just kind of the very most basic thing is, are you compliant? You don't know, your team doesn't know. And I'll say this is not the designer's fault. Like this is a problem structurally of companies that they should be allowing like legal and policy teams to collaborate with design teams, like much more fully collaborate. This is where you not only get compliant design, you also, I think, get more human rights aware design. I'm a big proponent of an area called human rights centered design. This is something myself and like a variety of human rights researchers have been really pushing this idea of human rights-centered design. How do you bring human rights into human-centered design? And that's where also legal and policy teams are really integral. This is also where trust and safety teams are really integral to regular design teams, right? Being able to understand human rights inside of a design practice. Because even if you aren't violating regulation, you might be actually impeding aspects of human rights and human rights policy. And I think, like, if we're interested in making responsible technology and equitable technology, we have to center human rights in this conversation. So one thing straight off is you might think you're making compliant design and you might not be. So this is why you definitely need a legal team involved in your design with you, because they can tell you exactly what is compliant, what is not. Or they might raise a question of, we don't know if this is compliant. And then that's an issue, because if you don't know and you put something out, you can still face a fine, right? So that's just right off the bat. In terms of how we impact executives, like, Lord, if I know, because I'm not sure how to, like, sort of structure those conversations. This is more to say for, like, senior managers listening and for designers as well. And also for folks that are not designers, you know, designers that are, like, kind of in the middle of the chain, like, we don't necessarily have that much of an impact. And so I say that for outsiders to say, oh, designers should just do X. It's like, well, no, there's a lot of structural things that get in our way, including executives, including top managers, right? Like, that sort of impede responsible design. And that's just something I want to highlight. I don't know how we go about impacting that, but I think that that's something that I want legal practitioners and academics to understand, is that the reason I don't think it's just education or it's saying, like, it's an individual designer's fault is because it's not. It's because often people are told to make something a certain way, and, like, they are so much lower on the food chain that they can't impact the making, right? Without, like, losing their job, without sort of facing some kind of internal critique or harm, or, you know, getting a bad review, you know, when it comes to review time, for example. And those things have, like, real impacts on an individual designer. So this is to say that I don't think the problem is all individual designers doing something wrong. I think a larger issue is also that managers in, like, the executive level and C-suites are also asking for harmful design and are not willing to compromise or understand why it's harmful. In terms of how we combat that, I'm really not sure, but I think it's something we have to combat.
Yeah, I think it just, I mean, not to reduce it to one thing, but it ends up being, how do you connect responsible design to the bottom line, at least in a Delaware C corporation, right?
Totally. I mean, that is really where I say, like, fines are expensive and so is losing consumer trust. Like, that's how I try to upsell it, is, like, here's all the fines you could get. Like, here's what that means. Here's, like, why you would want to avoid that, you know? But, like, sometimes people don't listen to that. And then they're shocked when they, like, get a fine, or they're shocked when, like, they get labeled as, like, harmful design or deceptive design. They're like, I had no idea. And it's like, well, we told you. We told you that, like, this might happen. And then here you are, you know? So I will say that, like, consumer trust is expensive and easy to lose, and, like, impossible at times to, like, build back up. So I think that that is, like, a big thing that folks listening to really do need to be aware of, especially for, like, managers out there, that it is really, really easy to lose consumer trust when you utilize harmful design patterns. Like, that does erode consumer trust. It makes your product more of, like, a cognitive burden for folks to use. When you make things more difficult, you're creating a less great experience for folks. And, like, people talk about that. People think about that. Like, consumers are aware of that. Even if they don't know it's called a harmful design pattern, like, they are aware when they're using something that's friction filled, or it's tricking them, or it's overtly confusing. Like, folks are aware of this.
One thing I just wanted to close the loop on is, you have a human rights lab. What is it? And you were earlier chatting about talking to different teams about responsible design and how to incorporate human rights into design. What's a concrete example of this, just so listeners and myself can illustrate what that looks like and where tensions might arise?
Yeah, I mean, so we do a variety of different kinds of work in my human rights lab. We published a report over the summer with Tech Policy Press with Justin Hendricks on what is secure. So looking at barriers to secure and encrypted messaging. A lot of that was trying to understand really high-risk groups, and then also providing third-party sort of technical and design reviews of Telegram, WhatsApp, Signal, Facebook Messenger, Google Messages, and iMessage, meaning like there is, I think, very necessary roles for like third party audits, like of a human rights lab to sort of look at these systems and say, like, as a third party, we're not the company. And so this is like, this is our sort of assessment. We had found not flaws or vulnerabilities, but like potential issues. We flagged those for WhatsApp and Signal. I think that has ended up being really helpful in terms of building, again, like varying forms of public trust. And we highlighted different things we thought were harmful design patterns or confusing design within Facebook Messenger and Telegram in particular. So some of that is, you know, before we published, we like went to the companies that would listen to us. Telegram is impossible to get a hold of, but like we had meetings with the different companies that aside from Telegram, whose apps we looked at. So one thing was sort of explaining our rationale. We were working with reproductive justice activists in states where abortion is banned, and then journalists in India who are facing a lot of government pressure. And so by working with those two user groups, which have very different technologies, the journalists in India are very, very aware of tech censorship and how technology works. The activists we were working with in the American South did not. We're kind of able to provide this sort of like holistic overview and then provide suggestions. And so some of this was explaining how these two different groups, like what their needs were and like why their needs were not necessarily being met by aspects of the current products. And a lot of it was just sort of talking with them like through those various findings. So that's one way. Another thing we've done is like I've reviewed policy for different big tech and social media companies. And I often take a very sort of specific stance related to online harassment. One of the things has been really pushing for social media companies to rethink what makes a public person and how do you actually signal that to the individual themselves. So for example, a lot of folks that face online harassment become viral, like they become like an internet main character for a few days or for a few weeks or for a few months or even a few years. And thus they're a public person. And they at times will have less protections than a private person does. And they're often not aware of that. Like they're not aware that they are in a different like policy category. So a big thing is often pushing for and advocating to companies how to explain that to those consumers. Can you allow them ways to opt out? So not everyone benefits from being a public person, meaning like they aren't actually facing like monetary benefit and they're not actually getting support in the way you think that they would be for being a public person because they're not a celebrity. They're not like a star. They don't have a security team. They're often individual folks that are having to live like paycheck to paycheck. So that is like another way in which we've been trying to sort of integrate varying aspects of responsible design and human rights. Another thing is explaining or looking at how different design decisions impact different communities across the globe and different marginalized communities that need further protection. So that can be queer communities in a country where being queer is criminalized. Or again, this other example of people seeking abortions in states where abortion is now illegal. Those folks have like very, very specific threat models and very, very specific fears that they're having to deal with. And they are also facing state action, right? And so those are different ways in which we'll sort of talk about these default settings are not really benefiting that user. And in fact, because they're not aware of it, they're like more exposed to harm, right? Like they are inadvertently exposing themselves to harm. And that's not necessarily their fault because they're using the app in a very standard way. So some of that is saying like, can you change standard settings? Can you make features turned off and then people can go and turn them on? And can you design from this perspective of that more and more users are facing these different kinds of harms? And so I think a lot of it's providing like those different kinds of examples and or again, bringing in. So one thing we do is we do a lot of co-design with those communities and we'll come back and say, this is what this community wants. This is why they want it. This is the feature they want. We've tested it on our end. We feel comfortable recommending that to you.
I see. So what are some concrete examples of this?
Turning off location tracking immediately, right? So like turning that off. Now with Facebook Messenger now being end-to-end encrypted, turning that on by default, which I think it is, but prior it was not. So people were not aware of when they were using different messaging services like that. One, people don't know what encryption is, but they think things are secure when they're not secure. And so I think that that is actually like a big burden that companies have to take, right, on their part. So a big thing was really sort of pushing for, okay, why isn't this end-to-end encrypted and by default, right? Another thing was like saying, why are you calling them secret? That doesn't really quite make sense. And that's not translating to most people, but also they don't know where to find that feature. A big thing with folks facing harassment is they want more tooling to be able to make themselves safer. I have an entire report called Trust Through Trickery that actually goes into all different kinds of features people could use. I'm not going to name them all here because they're in the report, and they're also in a Slate article I wrote a few years ago that really outlines all of those features. But one thing is like batch reporting of harassment reports, being able to have a draft harassment report that's easy to find. These aren't features that are easy for users to access or use, and there isn't batch reporting. So sometimes people face a persistent harasser, and to a content moderator, it doesn't look like harassment because the moderator is only seeing an individual case of harassment. They're not seeing like the history of reports this person has made. So like they're actually missing a large piece of context that a victim can't show, right? Or sometimes like a victim has been blocked by a harasser. And so being able to have someone like a friend, like electing, like you as a user electing a trusted person to go and send you stuff. And then you can say like this person who in your product I elected as like a trusted person, right, has sent me these examples and now I'm going to report them and put all of that again into a report. These are basic things that like people need. It's very destabilizing and uncomfortable and upsetting when folks report harassment and it's not seen as harassment by a platform. But there are other things like we need more nuanced privacy settings so folks can still use an app without having to leave it when they're facing harassment. And that's, again, a lot of those nuances are in this report. But again, that can be like more personalized privacy settings, right? A big thing that came up many years ago in my Gamergate research was, can it look like you're private to like non-followers or that you aren't tweeting when you actually are tweeting without having to sort of lock your account or make it private? So during Gamergate, a lot of Gamergaters would harass a victim to the point to where the victim would have to go private. And then they would take that as a sign that they had won, that they were right, that whatever they're harassing the person about, that like they had been right in that harassment because this person had to go private and that meant that person had something to hide or that person was like disappearing. So it became like a sign of victory to these harassers. For the victim, it's an awful emotional negotiation they have to go through because they don't really want to go private. They want to still be public and tweet and have their tweets engaged with, right? But it feels bad being forced to go into something, to do something, right? Another thing could be, again, batch blocking, like anyone that's using a hashtag, maybe they can't see your tweets. Like if someone is using a specific kind of hashtag, can you either block everyone using that or at least have it to where like they can't see your tweets, for example. So they don't realize they're blocked, but they don't because it doesn't look like they're blocked. Like different things like that, right? Again, I know that some of these might sound silly, but a lot of this is really thinking about the nuances of harassment that sometimes like blocking someone can increase harassment, for example. So what are ways that something can be a block without looking like a block, for example? And so I think a lot of this is thinking about much more granularity and nuance. Like there's all different kinds of harassment. So we have to stop looking at harassment tooling as sledgehammers or features that benefit the most. Right? So saying like, well, blocking works instead of what Caroline's describing. Right? Well, that works for a group of people, but that doesn't work for everyone. And the folks that it doesn't work for, it's causing a lot of problems for. So why can't we create these more granular features for the folks that want to use these things, that also actually need to use these things to be able to use your platform?
Yeah, I think one thing that you're mentioning, when a product is scaled, it's trying to hit a certain type of persona. And what personas are not accounting for are the different nuances of the personas are an aggregate. And they're not accounting for marginalized groups. And I guess like a lot of it also comes down to scale is when you're scaling, you're not going to give a lot of individualized attention to different groups. You're just going to look at the majority user and the majority problem or feature set to go for. And when different product managers or different companies are prioritizing different features, the feature that affects most people or affects the bottom line the most is the one that gets prioritized. Just to add like one nuance into harassment reporting is, what about public political figures? in that case, or should they be regulated to keep their comments on? Or if, for example, if you're like Instagram and or Twitter and you only allow any Republic figure, like, I don't know, like Ted Cruz, and you only allow for certain people to comment on your Facebook page or Twitter page, should that be allowed?
I mean, one thing I will say is I think public figures are a whole, like public political figures, like elected officials are a whole other bucket. And I think it's really important to separate those buckets, right? Like a journalist in a country where like journalism is under heavy attack and censorship is different than a journalist in a country where there isn't censoring of the press, right? And I think like those delineations are really, really important, like to understand and to also have nuanced policy around. Like not all journalists are the same, sadly, because some are facing real active threats and like physical harm and violence and even death by governments, and some in other locations are not. And I think that requires a lot of nuanced policy.
One thing I really want to chat about a bit is, since you studied photography, you've been a photographer, wanted to talk about how you see the analog between photography and generative AI in how should an artist be able to copyright / trademark the art. And, like, for example, right, photography used to be a lot more technically heavy. Maybe there's like a dark room aspect to it that you had to go and develop the film, and that doesn't exist anymore. So if you take a picture of a celebrity, who owns that picture? Is it the person taking the picture or is it the celebrity themselves? And then how we can translate the learnings of the past like 150 years of photography into like the nascent space of generative AI?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a really great question. So like one thing I will say is that photography is still definitely a very technical medium. Like even if you're shooting digitally, like there's still a lot of technical nuance, I would argue, like to it for sure. But one thing I will say is that like there is a history of photography and like a practice of photography. I would argue similar to like film, right? Where a photographer maybe has a vision, they set something up, they are really meticulous in how it's made. So like similar to like how, let's say, like Martin Scorsese or Spike Lee makes a film. They might not actually be behind the camera, like rolling film, right? Like out there, like hitting like the play button, but they've spent a lot of time crafting the world and like designing the world and working with other artisans and craftspeople and practitioners to make that world, right? Maybe they've written the script as well. Photography is also very similar. There are photographers that don't actually push the button, but they've crafted an entire like narrative and studio to sort of make that image possible, right? And they're still creating the image, I would argue. I think what's different from generative AI, and I think a lot of people that are heavily into generative AI and text prompts will probably disagree with this, but like when you write a text prompt, even if you are very aware of the text prompt and you like know what's going to, you think you have an idea of what's going to pop up, you actually also don't know because you don't know what's in the data set or the training set, right? And that's different from saying, I want to build this kind of set and it's going to look like X. I'm going to have all these things in it, because you're still very fine tuning that, right? I think another difference is just like technically the output of an image from generative AI, like is different from when I manipulate an image in Photoshop, right? Like there's a lot of manipulation I can do. There's a lot of things I can add to it or take away. I'm not opposed to generative AI, but I see them as different things because I see like a lot more control and nuance in photography in a way that's also constrained by reality. So like there's a lot of things about generative AI that I think are really fascinating. And again, I'm not anti it as a creative force, but I think that a lot of folks that talk about generative AI like don't actually have a background in media, like media history. Again, photography is a great example of this. Not all photographers press the button, but they're still photographers, right? Photography does have photo manipulation within it, and it has a long history of photo manipulation. I think what's different about photography is I'm still constrained by gravity and reality and the physics of light, like how light works. Like how lights can work or do function. I can manipulate lights by setting up other lights to make sunlight look like it's bouncing in a room in a way that's physically impossible, right? But I'm still constrained by certain things. And I think that's actually what I find interesting about photography, is that those constraints at times. Whereas generative AI, you're not constrained to that. My biggest issue with generative AI, again, isn't people creating with generative AI. It's the fact that most likely every generative AI system is using copyrighted images without the creator's consent. That's my issue with it. It's really simple. If someone can show me a generative AI system that they can guarantee there's not child exploitive sexual imagery in there and there's not copyright violations, then I would say go for it and use it. Go forth. You should use that. But that's been really hard to prove. So like my skepticism of generative AI has nothing to do with the creation process, more everything to do with the fact that it's using images in an unethical way. Because I believe in consent, credit, and compensation for creators. So I think as a photographer, I need to give consent for my images being in that data set. I need credit for my images being there once I consent to it. And I need a form of compensation. The same way that when I license my photographs to a photo agency or to like a photo firm online, and people want to, you know, purchase them like from a Getty or an Almy, you know, that I'm receiving some like credit and compensation for that, right? That this is.
Yeah, I think what it's coming down to here is you're arguing that the provenance of the images is not necessarily with the person putting out that text prompt, but it's with the creators that were non-consensually having their images in the training set.
Yeah.
And they're the true artists behind the machine. It's almost like a ghost in the machine type thing where the ghost is like the millions of artists or unpaid artists that didn't get paid to be in the training
set. Totally. Yeah. And yeah. I will say like,
I'm almost seeing it as a form of plagiarism, I guess.
Because it is, right? If you're violating someone's copyright, isn't that, maybe the exact word isn't plagiarism, but it's close to it. But one thing I will say is like, you asked a very interesting question that I don't have a direct answer on, but I do think is worth talking about, which is like, who owns the image of the person? And like, I think that that is really interesting and gets really complicated with like paparazzi images, for example. Right? That like often what makes a paparazzi image interesting is the famous person within it, right? But that famous person does not own the image, even though it's like their face that makes it beautiful. I will say like, when I take a photograph of someone, we sign a release. I am very clear with how I'm using it. And like often they're compensated for it, or they're compensated, if not with money, in some way, shape or form, meaning that like I give them raw files and they're kind of allowed to do with the raw files whatever they want to, right? But there is often like an exchange and there's like an agreement in place, right? But I'm not like photographing famous people. I'm photographing usually like my family or friends when I'm photographing people.
Almost saying that generative AI artists are kind of like paparazzi artists, paparazzi photographers.
Yeah, I can definitely see that in some ways, especially if they are like, give me a Scarlett Johansson like figure for sure.
But not even that way, more in the way that like the person doing all the work is the celebrity in the paparazzi photo, and the person doing all the work in the generative AI case is the people that contributed to the data set.
I would say it's probably a bit messier. I'm not saying this to defend paparazzi, but there are like beautiful photographs that paparazzi have taken that like they took it. Like they were out there in the right spot, the right time. Like they actually did the labor. But again, what makes the photograph expensive, right, and like worth money is because it is of the famous person. So I would say it's complicated, but I would say like, it's more similar to like, so I'd say that there's probably not a clean analogy or metaphor with generative AI to something we currently have, because generative AI isn't the same as like collage art, right? For example, whereas like in collage art, you're using pre-printed material, but it's often, you know, when you make a collage, unless you scan it and make a print, like you're making a one-off and you're using like a media that you've taken apart and you've remixed, and you've remixed enough that like, so you can like remix current images enough to where they are something inherently different. And then that's how you can sort of use, I think, sort of go around the copyright. I'm not a copyright expert, but it becomes an argument you make of like, how much did you change the image? But I think what's different with generative AI is that with generative AI, what's different is that your images could be used hundreds of thousands of times and you just have no idea. And so I think that there's not a clean metaphor for how to look at current media, like current media history and generative AI to talk about the use and misuse.
Yeah, I don't think for all these things, like metaphors are, they're helpful to understand, but they're never the full picture. thanks for coming on the show. Appreciated your time and learned a lot.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Yeah, thanks, you too.
If you enjoyed today's conversation, please share this episode to your friends so we can continue making episodes like this. Today's episode was produced by me, Talha Baig. Music by Zhao Shen. And special thanks to Sahar, Cass, Rachel, and Sean for their continued support.